Let me say good afternoon and welcome. I'm Frank Verastro. I'm Director of the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS. I'm welcoming you today to what we hope will be both an educational and perhaps a notationally challenging event. We've done nuclear events here before. And internally, that's kind of the joke that we have with our staff, that this is our small nuclear event, which the IAEA frowns on that characterization. But it's increasingly important. Because as you start looking to rethink, the sessions we've had here in the past have dealt with things like cost containment, upfront costs, security risks, investment risks, what you do with the cycle in terms of proliferation and protecting assets, transportation, but also the issues of just how nuclear fits into the energy mix. And by any forecast on energy demand going forward, both in the U.S. and globally, nuclear has to play a role. The question is what role, what kind of investment, what kind of time frame, and are there changes on the horizon that helps us kind of refocus and reframe that debate? Thus far, I think large gigawatt-sized reactors have dominated the plans to build new nuclear in this country and also globally. But it's time maybe to change that. If you believe some of the forecasts that we've seen on demand growth, especially after we've hit the economic recession, and you look at mandates for renewables, new items for efficiency, how much nuclear do we actually need? So is 1,000 megawatts, you know, too big of a chunk to swallow? Does it cost too much? Is it too difficult to build? Are there opportunities to scale and size right size, some of these facilities so that they have different applications, whether it's for oil sands development or whether it's for military facilities, whether it's for communities to do things both in the United States and globally? And as we grapple with the huge upfront costs for these reactors and we look at fabrication, does changing the system and allow you to manufacture vessels that are of smaller size and then deliver these things intact, does that give you an inherent advantage where you can right size and then supplement if you need to build larger rather than building a large-scale facility right from the get-go? We've been looking at ways and talking about ways that we stimulate this new nuclear renaissance for at least a couple of years now. And this might be one of the ways to jumpstart that. So today we're indeed fortunate to be able to bring together a panel of experts that are pioneering this idea of smaller and more flexible designs for deploying nuclear energy, ones that take a unique approach to address some of the ongoing challenges that have confronted the nuclear option going forward. The technologies and models you hear about today are at different stages in terms of commercial readiness, and we'll talk about that as the panel discusses it. And they're at different stages in terms of regulatory review. But they all constitute what we think is a creative rethink on how we might proceed with nuclear energy going forward. The full bios on each of the speakers are in the information packets you should have received when you walked in. But in order of presentation, they're going to include today Mr. Christopher Mowry, who's the president and CEO of Babcock & Wilcox Modular Nuclear Energy, LLC, Mr. Paul Lorenzini, the CEO of NuScale Power, Incorporated, Mark Campagna, the Chief Operating Officer of Hyperion Power Generation, and Dr. Lainam Chang, who's Dean of the College of Science at Virginia Tech, and he will discuss his team's concept and the project of GemStar. We've asked each of our speakers to kind of limit their presentations to 12 to 15 minutes within reason. They've also agreed that while they'll do a little bit of an advertisement and tell you where they come from, the bulk of these presentations will be on the substance. And they've all allowed us, with their permission, the entire session's on the record, and we will provide the slides on our website so you'll be able to download this material because it's resource-rich. If you can hold your questions till the end, typically for these sessions, because we're going to audio record it as well, what we'd like to do is hold the questions till the end. We should have ample time. We've allowed an hour and a half, hour and 45 to get this done. So we've got a kind of a diverse audience today, and I suspect the questions will be all over the board, but I'm sure that our panel can handle it. So let me thank you in advance for your courtesy and attention. Probably now is a good time to turn off or mute your cell phones, because that would be really helpful. And let me turn to Chris to get us started. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Frank. Actually, I think you did a great job in setting the stage for the conversation today. You know, commercial nuclear is a bit of a crossroads right now. If you look at the U.S., I think if you're being generous, we're really looking in the near term at about four large nuclear projects, maybe six going forward in the near term, down from, you know, something close to 20. You look in Europe and you see some unfortunate challenges with a number of large projects. And so I think the discussion relative to a different approach here is very timely, and at least from our perspective, it seems to resonate very well with the ultimate users, the utility industry, both in the U.S. and abroad. I think what I want to focus on here in my my 12 to 15 minutes is a specific piece of this thing, which is very important, and that is, what exactly are we trying to fix? What problem is trying to be solved here by a modular, scalable approach to nuclear? And when you start to look at this thing, you find, from a real-world, practical perspective, there are some very tight boundary conditions, some tight constraints, not only on the problem that's trying to be solved, but from a realistic perspective, what the spectrum of possible solutions are and what form they can take. So I think, Frank, you mentioned a couple of these things, these geopolitical motivators. But again, just to reinforce some of these, the supply chain that supports the gigawatt class of reactors, and I think the poster child for that is the ultra-large forgings for the bottom and top heads. There's only very few locations that can make those today. And if you're a U.S. Utility, that supply chain is very, very long, both in time and in distance. And that translates into risk for the project, both on a schedule and a cost perspective. Field craft labor, you know, the supply of, for example, skilled nuclear welders is not what it used to be in the 70s and 80s. And so the challenge of building a gigawatt-class reactor in the field, which is essentially still more or less done the way it was before, a stick-build traditional construction approach, is dependent on a very restricted number of skilled and qualified construction workforce. Then from a project siting perspective, and I think this is where things start to get more interesting, the fact is that gigawatt-class reactors have a very limited number of locations from a practical perspective where they can be sited. And I think, again, the poster child for that is transmission access. Most of you probably are aware it's probably harder to get rights to build a new transmission line or transmission spur than it is to get NRC license. And so trying to find a location where you can build this in the U.S., and this is a challenge not only for the U.S., but globally, is the actual size and ability of a power or transmission grid to support a gigawatt-class reactor. You know, a good rule of thumb is you don't want any of your power plants to be bigger than 10% of your grid. So if you're a developing country and you have a total transmission grid of 2,000 megawatts, you certainly can't be having half of that come from one power plant. So that's a real challenge. And there are some other emerging issues. Another one of them that's important here is water rights. And the fact is that most large power plants today use a lot of cooling water. And with droughts and climate change, whatever you want to call it, that's becoming more of a challenge from a permitting aspect. So these are some of the real-world challenges that face an industry that really is looking for carbon-free, reliable baseload generation. That's really what they're looking for. So what is it that the industry really wants out of modular nuclear? And this is where I come back to the boundary conditions. The first one is a bit self-evident, and that's the biggest challenge with the large gigawatt-class reactors. You're really betting the company on a power plant, on one power plant, because the fact is the cost of one of those is larger than the market capitalization of probably almost all the utilities in North America. These next items are very important in terms of providing a path forward for modular nuclear and whether it will really turn into something or whether it's just going to be an R&D exercise. The fact is that the U.S. nuclear industry has had an unparalleled record of reliability and safety in the last 20 years. They really have learned the lessons of some of the unfortunate incidents that occurred in the 70s and 80s, both here and abroad. And they've spent billions of dollars on putting together an infrastructure and a process for operating these power plants, All of these power plants are light water reactor-based technologies. So whether you're talking about INPO, the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations, whether you're talking about training programs, whether you're talking about the infrastructure to support licensing and operations, all of that is well understood by the industry. And frankly, there's not much interest out there in reinventing the wheel because it works very, very well. In fact, we wouldn't even be here to talk if the average capacity factor of these large plants weren't over 90%. The other part of this thing is the existing infrastructure, and a good example of this is the nuclear fuel supply chain. I mean, it's one matter to have a discussion about the industry adopting a change in direction and a new approach to nuclear, but on top of that, if you're asking them to adopt, for example, a new nuclear fuel supply chain that moves away from what they have today, I think you move outside of the box in terms of what is a credible and practical solution that the industry will really adopt in any meaningful way. So this is a bit of an advertisement, so I'll skip it. But the point here really is that this is all about risk management. If you go back to that previous slide, what the industry wants is they want cost certainty, schedule certainty, and an affordable power plant. And so one dimension of cost and schedule certainty comes from a shorter, more vertically integrated supply chain. So whatever supplier is going to go into this, one of the things that I think is a must-have is a proven vertically integrated supply chain to take that piece of the risk equation off the table. The concept of modular reactors, and when I talk about modular reactors, what I'm talking about is what we call an integral nuclear steam supply system, which means all of the pieces, what are traditionally multiple components that are built in the field, are really contained within a single module. And that's key because the objective here is to move the kind of custom-made field construction activities into a factory setting where you can get simplification, you can get cost advantage, and you get quality improvements. And so this process started in the 1950s and 60s with the first commercial nuclear ships and then has moved on, and this is B&W's solution. And the relevant pieces of this thing are that the envelope of this reactor vessel is essentially the largest thing that you can make in a factory and, from a practical perspective, ship somewhere on a rail car. So it's about 15 feet wide and 75 feet long and weighs about 500 tons. So if you're a utility industry, you like the idea of modular, and that pushes the concept of going small, but there are real negative economies of scale. So you really want to make it as big as you can get it while still making it in a factory. And that constraint is really the transportation constraint and a weight constraint. And so the envelope of this thing, again, getting back to boundary conditions and constraints, is, hey, how big can you make something and still make it in a factory and ship it? Because that maximizes the power increment. And if your goal is to apply modular nuclear to baseload power generation, you need something that moves the needle. I mean, it doesn't do anybody any good to invest hundreds of millions of dollars to get 1 megawatt, because one of the advantages of nuclear from a clean energy that's very different than solar or wind, it is high-density power, okay? And so you really want to do that. These other attributes here really focus on the concept of utilizing the existing infrastructure and proven technology, because clearly the industry is interested in this thing because they're looking to repower old carbon-intensive generating assets. And if you talk to the industry, they see that real horizon coming in the latter half of next decade. They want something that is, from a practical perspective, licensable and deployable in that time frame. So you get back to practical realities. You really can't be in R&D space today if you really want to deploy one of these things before 2020. So utilization of proven technology, of existing fuel supply chains, all of those are must-haves for modular nuclear reactors to be deployed in this time frame. Here's just a couple of fun facts about this, about the reactor. Again, I think the main point here is it's based on proven technology. It uses, in this case, B&W's once-through steam generator technology, which is used today out in the field with PWRs and has a long track record. It uses standard PWR fuel, and there's another number of other features in here, none of which conceptually is any different than what's deployed from a technology perspective, but equally importantly, is not outside the box in terms of regulatory framework, because this whole thing has to get approved by the NRC. And as soon as you get into new technologies and new ideas, you're really lengthening that and creating uncertainty in the licensing process, which gets back to violating one of the fundamental goals of this thing, which is risk certainty. Just a minute here on the nuclear island, and this gets back maybe to some of the non-proliferation security things. Turns out that this approach, you can really store all the spent fuel that would be produced by this plant for the entire 60 years of the life inside the containment. So hopefully by then we have another solution to Yucca Mountain. The other key to modular reactors without crossing an important line is simplification, because there are otherwise very negative economies of scale, and the industry has tried in the past to basically shrink down the large gigawatt-class reactor designs to 500-600 megawatts, and when you do the math, you make it unaffordable. So you really need to start with a much more simple approach. But at the end of the day, it has to have a look and a feel that is reasonably close to what the industry has experience with today, good experience, or it's never going to be accepted by the industry. So and again, in terms of implementing modular nuclear, the concept is that you want to be able to build a scalable power plant by aggregating one or more modules together. We believe that one of the requirements for this is that each module has to be in its own independent nuclear island. So from a regulatory perspective, as soon as you start sharing safety systems or other things, then you get in a licensing space where it becomes tough to, for example, build out a plant site in an incremental basis where perhaps you build 125 megawatts this year, and 3 years later you want to put in another 125 to go with your load growth. If you can't do that, if all these things are tied together in some way, you get into a bit of a quandary from a regulatory perspective. I think that's my 15 minutes. All right, thank you.
Thanks.
Our speakers never hold to our time limits. This is impressive. Paul, go ahead.
I promise not to either. My name is Paul Lorenzini. I'm the CEO of NuScale Power. I'll be repeating a lot of the same things, themes that you just heard, but perhaps a little different spin to it. Let me start by introducing you. Y'all like it so far?
Yeah,
okay. So this is me, Paul Lorenzini. Our chief technical officer is Jose Reyes, Dr. Jose Reyes. Let me start by introducing you to NuScale Power. Our technology was developed under a contract with the Department of Energy in the 2000 to 2003 timeframe in conjunction with Idaho National Laboratory and Nexant, which at the time was a subsidiary of Bechtel. The contract included the construction of an integral test facility. In 2003, the ownership of that facility and the technology was transferred to Oregon State, and in the meantime, they developed and modified and improved the design. We formed NuScale Power in 2007 to take the company commercial under a technology transfer agreement with Oregon State University. Now, what I would tell you is that when we first started having conversations, at the time, I believe there were about 50-plus small reactors that people were working on in different phases throughout the world. And whenever you mentioned the word small reactors, the immediate assumption was distributed generation, remote locations, developing countries. And no matter how much you talked about it, that was the assumption, that was the concept. So I want to start by suggesting a different framework for having that conversation, because we asked ourselves, if we go after the domestic market, what's the right way to do that? So this is a configuration that's a little bit different today, but this is a configuration of what a 500-megawatt plant would look like with new scale modules. Now, if you look, it's a top-down. It's a little complicated, but what you see in the middle is the module, and then it goes out. Each one has its own dedicated turbine generator, and they're each independent systems. They're all independent of each other, and so you got here a 500-megawatt plant. It's a plant that could be phased in. You could add generation to match load growth. And what's important about this plant is not how big is the module. What's important about the plant is it's 500 megawatts and the total economics of that 500-megawatt plant. People who buy this plant are going to buy the plant because the economics are the right economics and because it's got the right footprint and because it's got the right safety story and because it can be licensable. So those are the key parameters to pay attention to. This is the concept. A schematic. It's very, very simple. What you see is the reactor and the containment. As Chris said, it's sized 60 feet by 15 feet, about 500 tons. So same criteria, shippable, except that in our case, it includes the containment. So there's the containment plus the pressure vessel. So one key is shippable manufacturing offsite, shippable to the site. Second key is cooled by natural circulation, so no pumps, no pipes. We eliminate failure modes. Very, very simple. And the third key, to stress the point that Chris made, all proven technology. Every point along the way, standard PWR fuel, light water technology, standard control rod drive mechanisms being manufactured by Curtis Wright. Pumps. So this is all, you look at this, and it's not only simple, it's proven. There's nothing here that's magic in terms of how the plant would be built and operated. This is what it looks like, a schematic, and you can see again, the outer structure is the containment. Inside that is the pressure vessel. Inside the pressure vessel, you've got the reactor down low, a helical coil steam generator at the top. Hot water goes through the reactor, heats up, comes down around the outside, and makes steam. Validated by an integral test facility. So this is not a PowerPoint design. We have a test facility, one-third scale, electrically heated, that is at pressure, at temperature, and links all these pieces together for the entire safety story for the plant. And it was built and designed by Jose Reyes, who built and designed the test facility that was used to license the AP1000. So if you come to Oregon State, you go into one building and you see a one-quarter scale, 1/7 scale replica of the entire AP1000 plant that was used to license the AP1000 plant. And then you go across the hall into another building and you see the replica of our plant. And two things. Number one, it's a plant that validates the safety case. And number two, you can get the idea of how simple it is. A picture's worth 1,000 words. You look at one and you look at the other and you say, I get it. Now, what we do is we take a number of these and put them together. So each one has its own dedicated turbine generator. People have said, why don't you hook up, more than one to more than one turbine to a single turbine generator? We could get economics by doing that, but as Chris pointed out, you don't want to get these systems tied together, so each has its own complete independent powertrain. And then you group a bunch of them together, and that's how you get a large power plant. So why would you do this? Chris talked about the issue of cost. This is a chart that's been put together by J.P. Morgan, and what it shows is the capitalization of major utilities in this country, and the two red lines bracket the kind of financial commitment that these companies are being asked to make in building these large nuclear plants. Now, some can make it. For some, it's the right thing to do, but it's a huge financial bet. As one CEO of a big company told me, he said, we're being asked to invest, to put $10 to $15 billion on the table. Going to be on the table for 10 to 15 years. That's three presidential administrations and maybe the life of two popes. He said that's a huge risk to ask us to make, and it's very difficult for us to get commercial terms to take that risk. So there's a lot that drives people to want to build nuclear plants. There's a lot of nuclear plants being built today, but this is the big challenge financially in getting them built. So what does modularity give you? Modularity gives you a chance to build it incrementally, to not make the big bet, to build it small first and add to it. It gives you the advantage of being able to do the manufacturing. Imagine the construction site at a nuclear plant where you've got scaffolds, you've got all this construction going on with the containment, and we take all that off-site. And so it's basically what's left on the site is a standard commercial construction project, and we deliver to the site the entire nuclear plant containment and all. And so it changes entirely the risk profile And it allows somebody building a plant to be able to control their schedule and control their risks in a different way. Capacity can be added sequentially. We don't need to put all the modules in at once. We can reach a market that that other plants can't reach. There's a huge market out there in the 300 to 500 megawatt range. And, you know, just a footnote here, this is not just about saying that you're going to build modular plants instead of big plants. Part of the issue here is how does nuclear power play an important role in our national energy policy? When you look at climate change policy, there are basically only three sources of baseload generation. Two are fossil, gas and coal, and one is nuclear. If you look at the annual energy outlook for 2009, 72% of all new generating capacity projected between 2007 and 2030 is fossil fuel, coal and natural gas. That is not a sustainable climate change policy. If you change that policy, you're going to have to move from that to something else, and the only baseload capacity, as Secretary Chu has repeated over and over again, is nuclear. And so part of the issue is how can we create a nuclear opportunity where we maximize the ability of nuclear power to penetrate the market and be part of that policy. And so when we talk about this here, we're talking about a different way of building nuclear plants that increases the ability of policymakers to look at nuclear power as a viable way to impact climate change policy. One of the things that utilities like when they look at that picture is no single shaft risk. One unit goes down, the whole plant doesn't go down. And so they lose 45 megawatts, they don't lose the whole plant. We're able to take one unit off, refuel while the rest of the plant operates, so you never shut the whole plant down. Proven PWR, LWR technology. Pathway to licensing, a regulatory process that is well-designed, and we would be licensed within the existing regulatory framework. No new rules have to be adopted, maybe a couple on the outer edges, but basically standard light water reactor licensing. Robust supply chain with U.S. manufacturers. A, we don't have to go to Japan Steelworks to get our vessels forged. B, we've got several companies in this country with a lot of nuclear experience. The supply chain is important. And so we've got companies like Electric Boat, companies like Curtiss-Wright, companies like Precision Cast Parts, all of whom have told us that they want to build our module and that they're prepared to do that. So robust supply chain, more than one, and we've got plenty that are qualified. The safety case, two things about the safety case. Number one, we get safety improvements. Now, I'm always careful when I say that because you don't want to make the implication that the existing nuclear plants aren't safe. We always have this argument. So let me just say it this way. The NRC goal is that the core damage frequency for a nuclear plant has to be less than once every 10,000 years. All the plants in the country beat that by a factor of 10, maybe a factor of 100. When the AP1000 came out, they beat it by another factor of 10. So they added to that. So it was better, safer. We come out and we add another factor of 10 to that. Now, how do we know that? We completed a Tier 1 probabilistic risk assessment. We've had two expert review panels look at our whole safety case to examine it. Are there any holes? What can you do differently? We've had four pre-application meetings with the NRC, and we've been able to confirm our basic concepts in our test facility. So we've got a safety case. We've got a concept for how all these pieces fit together, the importance of the pool of water, how our systems work together. And we've got a safety case that is well advanced and a safety case that has been looked at from several different directions, and we're confident it's a safety case that will get us through the NRC. Now, the other piece of this is cost, because ultimately we have conversations with people. They like it, say we really want to take this further, but how much is it going to cost? So we got a partnership with a major constructor, Peter Kiewit Company. Peter Kiewit has gone through a detailed cost estimate. We have a number. Not a number it's a number we're sensitive to announcing publicly, but what I will tell you is we've got a number that we're very confident when we sit down with utilities it's equal to or better than the numbers they're looking at for big plants. That by itself is significant because the premise has always been that in order to get economics, you have to have a big plant. We believe we're going to go to the market with a plant that is not big, that it captures what I call the economies of small and produces a dollar per kilowatt number capital cost that's going to be at or below the cost of existing plants. We've got customers who we're working with. We have a customer advisory board. We have a memorandum of understanding with a customer in the Northwest that's exploring siting a NuScale plant in their area. We've got discussions going on with major utilities, and we've had interest expressed by other countries as well. So there's a lot of interest in what we're doing, and we're confident that when we get out there with our economic numbers, which are really pretty new, that's going to grow. So lastly, policy issues. I've sort of hinted at some of these, but I think one key is validating as a matter of public policy the importance of having nuclear power be part of climate change policy. We say that. The fundamentals are there. It's got to happen at some point in time. But if you look at where the money is flowing to renewables, and there's a big gate that says we're not going to do the same things for nuclear that we're doing for other renewable policies. It's needed. It's needed in the area of plants like ours, because you've got first customers that are coming in and they're saying, who's going to help us over the hump with that first plant? That's the issue for every technology. And to the extent that U.S. policy begins to embrace the notion that nuclear power needs to be part of climate change policy, to the extent that it begins to embrace the notion that you need modular, scalable plants as part of that picture to maximize the penetration of nuclear power, to that extent, we'd like to see policy move more and more in the direction of embracing ways that we could facilitate this becoming part of the market. Barriers, no mystery. Time and cost. Takes a lot of money to get from here to the end of the line, and we got to get through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Those are barriers that we all face. Nuclear Regulatory Commission has their job to do. The issue is, how can we structure that process to facilitate that review and make it move as quickly as is reasonably possible? And the other issue is overcoming first-of-a-kind cost risks. I mentioned that. A policy that embraces modular, scalable light water reactors in such a way that there's a recognition that this is an issue for customers, and the government has an important role that they can play to assist that. So that concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Paul, thank you. Mark?
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Mark Compagna. I'm the COO for Hyperion Power Generation. I really feel that this is an important topic. What I'm talking about today is not baseload generation, as these gentlemen have done, and I think they present a very good case. I'm going to be talking about distributed power of smaller nuclear reactors. I will say that I've been involved in all sizes. I'm a retired Navy captain. I've qualified on three small reactors, also been involved with utilities and vendors and larger reactors. And I think there's a place for all these. But the one thing that Hyperion recognizes as we deploy the technology that has been successfully developed by the Los Alamos Nuclear Lab, and technology that's also been developed with the Naval Reactor Space Program folks, is that 90% of the world would not at this time need large nuclear reactors or even large transmission and distribution systems. They need distributed power. So that's the market we're going after. Okay, like I said, we are working now to with an exclusive license in a CRADA with Los Alamos Nuclear Lab. I think the applications here would be both the U.S. and international, and would be in the area of, as I'll show you later, 28 megawatts electric for each of the Hyperion power modules, which is enough to power 20,000 homes. We are working now on the initial stage of our capitalization, working the manufacturing design. We have stood up the program office and have our AEs working with the Hyperion folks and Los Alamos National Lab, who's the design authority. And we have assigned technical advisory boards and business advisory boards. We have a schedule that will get us into the USNRC next year for our first technical reviews that we are assembling internally and need to kick that activity off next year. And right now we've got commitments, customer commitments for 122 units around the world. This is a list of our advisors, partners and advisors. We've got Bill Anderson in the audience today in case we want to get in some questions, former Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Air Force for Energy Development. Also, Deborah Blackwell's in the audience, who is our local Vice President of Policy here in Washington. Okay, these are six features, and I'm not going to read them thoroughly because I know that you can read at 750 words a minute, and even I can talk at only 150 words a minute. So, but these are very good objectives that are important in these days, especially as you're looking at a portable world. Fitting the transportation issue in there, the safety, self-moderating number two and three, impossible to melt down, our safety issues, the no moving parts almost automatic operation makes this closer to a nuclear battery or fuel cell than to a conventional power plant. All right, and the simplicity of this means that we can get into a situation where within our safety envelope, and we're going to the marquee nuclear inspectorates, for instance, the USNRC, the UK, NII, CNSC in Canada, and making sure that we use all the proper general design criteria and safe PRA and all those requirements are done up front so that we bound the total plant and it may be different, as I'll show you, different applications, but we bound the entire plant and have a Hyperion power module that can operate in a flexible way around the world. This just shows an artist rendition. I've got a little bit more of a detailed drawing later, where, again, we place all the nuclear safety-related or important safety components underground and stage the what we run for 5 to 7 years on one Hyperion power module and then switch over to another one. And actually, our plans are to take the old one back and reuse or recycle it so that we can keep the plant going. And then all the not important to safety or conventional components are above ground, which minimizes the nuclear footprint substantially. This is just an artist rendering or a CAD drawing, one of our early CAD drawings that shows basically that we can fit this, an entire power plant on a very small surface. This would be less than half of a football field, and the underground portion of it is very manageable, no matter where you put it. Okay. Again, there are communities in cold regions or hot regions or deserted regions that could use a combination of these applications. I think that sometimes you've got people who are surviving or doing okay, but if you put a power source that can freeze their fish, provide them electricity, provide them heat when it gets cold, it enhances their lifestyle. That's one of the key objectives that we have, is to be able to do that. I think I was at the IAEA in Vienna a few weeks ago, and that is a very important theme for the world. Again, 90% of the world. I was very impressed that they had 50 countries that are being helped right now on doing a life cycle baseline planning for nuclear power applications. Over 175 countries have signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which means they have traded away any interest in nuclear weapons for the right to have access to appropriate nuclear technology. So there's a vast market out there of countries that are interested in this kind of a start. There may be some minimal base load, but again, that's for developing areas. Of course, mining, oil production and refining in Texas, there's severe restrictions on putting any carbon-emitting power sources up so that you can only get at difficult oil by using a nuclear plant and military facilities. Okay, so this shows an artist's rendering of oil and gas production. How am I doing on time?
You're not.
Okay?
Yeah.
All right. All right. Again, oil and gas, oil sands and shale are difficult to get at, like I said, and we can help cut the cost there and actually help the environment also with low to no emissions. So this is a remote area where, for instance, it's hard to get power for less than 35, 40 cents a kilowatt hour. We will generate for 10 to 15 cents a kilowatt hour. An example is Guam, where they're going to have to transfer 17,000 Marines there from Okinawa. But it's in literally, if you've been there, I'd be respectful, literally in the middle of nowhere. All right, so you have to get your energy in creative ways. All right, so again, a lot of the world has problems getting clean water and has problems getting access to energy to deal with that and has problems improving their lifestyle. They have social problems, therefore, and increased chances of behavior difficulties, including terrorism. This shows a potential military installation. Once again, maybe you wouldn't see it. It would be there working fine. The Cheyenne Mountain, which Bill and the Air Force folks are very proud of, and it's a great facility, but contains fossil emergency power. We would hope to make that a nuclear. Okay, once again, for military installations, the power is relatively secure. Even doing risk assessments, as we're doing now, the simplicity of this means that there's a limited number of accidents, and we double, triple cover all of them. We can fit into existing operations, and there are a lot of U.S. military bases in the world. Right. Solar and wind are great. They take up a lot of space. All of Manhattan would take all of Manhattan for solar or wind to power it. It would take one grid for nuclear out of 100. We're also looking in the U.K. The U.K. has made a decision to go with nuclear. There will be some need for remote areas to increase the standard of living, and we can help accomplish those goals. This is a list of our managers, and again, these will be available on the website, and HyperionPowerGeneration.com has more information if you'd like to see it. And Deborah is here in town, so I'm sure she would be glad to talk to you anytime. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Dr. Cheng.
Good afternoon, everyone. Can everyone hear me? Yeah. In many respects, a lot of what I have to say have already been said, and in terms of justifications of looking at nuclear as a viable option in fulfilling our energy needs in the future. What I'm here to describe for you this afternoon is a project that Virginia Tech is engaged in with a private company. We wanted to see, in a very important respect, what I'm about to tell you is different from what you have heard. We are exploring the possibility of a new technology. So we have all of those issues that has been brought up with nuclear regulatory commissions and so forth. But we feel that this particular approach that I'm going to be describing to you does address some critical issues when you're talking about nuclear power. We call the project GEMSTAR. As you can see, it stands for Green Energy Multiplier Subcritical Technology for Alternative Reactors. And what it is a proposal that incorporates an accelerator in the extraction of energy from the nucleus. My name is Lelam Chang. I'm the Dean of the College of Science at Virginia Tech, and I brought along two people who have worked extensively in this project. One is Bruce Vogelaar and Beata Schmidtmann. They're both in the audience. The idea of using accelerators in the nuclear power game is not new. What I'd like to do is just simply to walk you through very quickly as how the conventional light water reactor, how that works, what are some of the issues associated with it, and what are some of the existing techniques at dealing with these issues. So you start off with the uranium ore. You need to enrich it and fabricate the fuel. It goes into a light water reactor, powers up the generator. You get some spent fuel. You attempt to store it, and in some instances, you also attempt to go through a transmutation, and then use a fast reactor to see if you can extract some other power from the waste product. This is the way in which accelerators have been used in the nuclear power game. What we are attempting to do is to reframe the question and ask, in what context can we look at an optimized accelerator-driven nuclear reactor itself rather than dealing with the way in which I've described it? As I said, this is a partnership between ATNA, the private company, and the faculty and researchers at Virginia Tech. We think it's going to be truly transformative. We are in the process of attempting to working towards building up a demonstration model. The individual components of the technology are all proven, but of course, as with anything like this, the trick is in integrating. As I learned in elementary calculus, it's far easier to differentiate than to integrate. So what are the features of the GEMSTAR system? It is run at a subcritical level. It's graphite modulated. And the way it works is that the neutrons that neutrons are, of course, what makes the whole thing work, that the neutrons are supplied in part by the accelerator, which is going to be, which produces neutrons on a target that's exterior to the reactor. We are proposing a molten salt fuel configuration, which enables us to run the reactor in equilibrium. It allows a certain amount of economy. We operate this at high temperatures in order to improve the efficiency, but it is operated at a lower pressure. So some of the plumbing and everything else that goes along with the conventional reactor would be somewhat different, with some of the downsides of a light water reactor being minimized. It has high thermal to electric conversion, and we don't need to have a containment vessel. So then, diagrammatically, what you have in the GEMSTAR system then is power coming either from existing green power or some other grid to power the accelerator that will drive the whole system. And we believe, with the way in which we have configured it, that you get a multiplication factor typically of 35. So if you run this with 12 megawatts coming in, you can produce a 408 megawatt net output of electricity from this particular system. What kind of fuel are you going to be using? You can use natural uranium. The reason why you have to enhance uranium in running a traditional nuclear reactor, of course, is that U-238 doesn't fission that easily. You don't have enough neutrons to start the reaction. We are supplying the neutrons with an accelerator, so it is possible to use natural uranium. But what's more interesting is that it is possible to use the waste products from the existing light water reactors as the input fuel for a system like what it is I'm describing here. As I said, it burns natural uranium. If you site one of these reactors close to a light water reactor, you can directly use the waste from the light water reactor. Or alternatively, if you site remotely from some of the existing reactors, you can nonetheless transport the waste material from these existing reactors and use that as the input fuel. We estimate that this is a low-cost electricity for consumers, depending, of course, upon the desired multiplication factor. There is no need for uranium enhancement. This is one of the, we feel, one of the big attractions of this particular system. It will enable better monitoring of countries that are attempting to get electricity from nuclear reactors from coming up with centrifuges and all that. And you know what the story is. We have read about this in the newspapers a lot lately. With this particular system, since there is no necessity for uranium enhancement, some of these issues are, in fact, going to be eliminated. We can recycle the fuel. The waste products from this particular nuclear reactor can be used again and again. First pass, second pass, and third pass. Obviously, the amount of reactor power that you need to use in supplying more of the neutrons will correspond in an increase, but I think they, can be controlled. It breaks the link between nuclear energy and the issue of proliferation. This is a schematic of what the system would look like. I wish I had a pointer here, but to the right of the schematic over here, you see that we pump in 600 MeV protons on the uranium spallation source, generating neutrons, which then go through the molten salt and trigger the kind of nuclear chain reaction that you're looking for. The heat exchanger is outside of that, at the periphery of the reactor over there. The molten salt fuel is being constantly replenished so that it's operating on a steady state with some input fuel and then some output fuel, which you then recycle as you go along. One important thing to remember about the utilization of an accelerator. In the accelerator-driven transmutation method that I described to you earlier, which have been studied in the past, the kinds of accelerator over there are typically quite high in energy. You're typically talking about 1,000 million volts or gigavolt with a pretty hefty current, 100 milliamps typically, and it's operating at about 100 megawatts. The kind of accelerator you're talking about over here is somewhat lower. You don't need that much energy. And so the kind of accelerators that we're going to be talking about here is different from the accelerators that are typically used in the study of high-energy physics. Some of you, I'm sure, are aware of the fact that in Geneva, there's an attempt to build a super-duper accelerator to study the nature of of matter. Those accelerators are naturally extremely finicky. They have high demands, high energy, high current loads, and so forth. Those are not the kind of accelerators we're talking about. This just about concludes my presentation. We have some one-pagers that summarize some of the things I've talked about outside, and you are welcome to pick a copy up as you leave. Thank you so much for your attention.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. That was very informative. I I have a bunch of questions. So I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair here just to ask a couple. So we talked about many of the forecasts for advancing nuclear technology in this country to meet energy needs. Hard to see how we make those builds, both in the U.S. globally, with conventional nuclear. Yet the carbon constraints and the environmental challenges require that we kind of front-end load and move to lower emissions faster. So the first question is, to what extent do these applications or smaller-scale reactors help you make that target when you need to? And then in the case of, if it's not just an application, but, you know, Dean Chang, in your case, where you have a situation that it's kind of a new technology, and you're looking at Gen 3, Gen 4, how does the processing of an application at the NRC, how does that affect the development in actually getting into the system? So, Chris, if you want to start, and then we'll kind of move down.
Yeah, so you're talking about, I just want to clarify the question, is you're asking what the process would be to get these things from here to deployment?
How can it help? So by going with this, you know, sizing, scale, new applications, new technology, does it actually move up the time frames? You talked about a three-year construction cycle.
Yeah,
it easier to meet your climate goals.
Yeah, well, I think there's two dimensions to the answer. One is, and I think I mentioned this briefly in my remarks, nuclear today is only accessible to the very largest utilities. And in order to move the needle on climate change from a baseload power generation, you need to find a way to create access to nuclear to the part of the iceberg that's underwater, the small and medium-sized utilities in the U.S. That operate all of these old carbon-intensive power plants. And typically these power plants are 100 to 300 megawatts. They have existing infrastructure, but they're so old that there is no feasible technology to retrofit carbon capture, and so they just be shut down. And so the alternative really is to repower that with gas, as I think, Paul, you mentioned, is the one alternative, or potentially nuclear. But to do this, you need to have a smaller, scalable solution that fits within the footprint of an existing site that can utilize that existing infrastructure, the existing transmission line, the substation, and it fits within the site boundaries, which are real-world constraints. So one way to accelerate the process is to make nuclear accessible to a broader piece of the U.S. Electric power generation industry. I will tell you that the other dimension of that, of course, is none of these utilities are nuclear operating companies. So the last thing they want to do are be early adopters or first movers for new technology. And so they want to have something from a risk management perspective that's inside the box again on what's understood by the industry. And they're going to need to lever existing nuclear operating companies' capabilities to actually operate and maintain these facilities at least through a transitional period of time. So, again, they're going to need to reach into that existing infrastructure for this thing to get adopted. So if you're really talking about a broader application of nuclear power in the U.S. to help the climate change, you have to find a way to make it more accessible to the broader industry. And that, by definition, means that it cannot simply be although there is a role for the gigawatt-class reactors, most power generation, if you look at it in the U.S. from base load, is not made of 1,000-megawatt stations. They're in the 500 plus or minus megawatt class. And, again, that's where you balance the scale and is it worth the investment to put that in. So, again, there's a lower limit to this thing, but it has to be flexible enough to fit within the existing infrastructure.
I think the other aspect that hasn't been discussed is if you provide an alternative, and again, I'm from a standpoint of a distributed generation, provide a good alternative so they folks don't choose something that makes matters worse. So folks don't choose burning diesel. They will go with a small nuclear, a modular reactor. So I agree with the future orientation. Obviously, with these FOCIs or first of a kind, you have to get through a proper regulatory review, a proper country of origin plan for providing them and safely and with not with proliferation resistance and so forth. But once you get through that and get your initial lead launch installations in, you've already done your trench work, marketing, business development, whatever you want to call it, so that many of the folks that would have selected a problematic carbon solution will choose nuclear. So I think that's part of the next 5 to 10 year task.
Doctor? Yep. Thank you. I think that with GEMSTAR, the issue that we are looking at is an issue that presupposes, of course, that the nuclear option is something that we need to be looking at. With the current reactors that are in operation, there is the question of the waste. It isn't so easy to look at the waste products from a light water reactor and reuse it. With GEMSTAR, we have a means of taking that particular I really hate to use the word waste. I wish there's a better word that I can use. Unused fuel. Thank you. And use it. And we think that we can use it effectively. But if I may just add on to the discussion of why nuclear is essential, we have been talking almost entirely in terms of the production of electricity. I think, though, that as we go forward with the climate change that people are now looking at in terms of global warming and the like, there are going to be issues that would require more and more intensive use of energy. I'm thinking of water desalinization, the redistribution of water, and so forth. You can certainly live for a short period of time without oil. You can't live for too long without water. And I feel that in order to answer that question in a global fashion, you're going to need energy in a very intensive way. That is to say, you need to have the kind of energy in a big jolt almost instantaneously. And there aren't that many ways of doing it other than the ones that we already know from using hydrocarbons, other than nuclear. It's there. It can deliver for you a huge jolt. And if you can control it and get the kind of risk, there is no energy source that is so perfect that you don't have to worry about any waste products. The only silver bullet I can think of is coal fusion, and that is not going to be available tomorrow.
I can open it up for questions. First, can I ask you all to slide down a little bit before we lose our last speaker? I just noticed that, and I apologize. We have three speakers. Joe, go ahead. Two quick requirements here when we ask questions. Wait for the microphone and identify yourself. And then to the extent you can, please pose your question in the form of a question. Even if that just means inflection.
Yeah, my name is Joe Dukert. I'm an independent energy analyst and also a senior associate in political economy at CSIS. My question is to the first three speakers. It's multi-part. I apologize. There hasn't been as much detail as I think needs to be brought out, even though this has been a more detailed presentation than I have heard in years about these modular or small reactors. First of all, nobody mentioned enrichment, and the degree of enrichment reminds me that if you go back to the nuclear ship experience, the space reactors, they used fully enriched or very highly enriched. That affects cost. It affects proliferation resistance. I wonder also, in the case of the first two particularly, how you would handle refueling access or even maintenance for quality control in the period between refueling. I wonder how you'll handle heat rejection from the secondary system, which wasn't mentioned very much. B&W mentioned air-cooled condensers. Another speaker said we'll let the buyer decide about that. At the oil sands, all of you mentioned oil sands, I think. One question would be how you allocate process heat rather than input to electrical generation. And finally, 122 commitments. I wonder if the speaker who mentioned that could expand and tell us whether or not there are actually any military installations that are on the verge of ordering these.
Okay. All right. So let me just take these one at a time. Enrichment, great question, actually. And if I go back in time to our program, we were focused on the right technical answer, okay? And the right technical answer is for modular designs, certainly for advanced designs, to use, let's say, a 10% to 15% type enrichment fuel. But then you quickly realize the reality intrudes, and what is the probability of public acceptance of 15% enrichment fuel in someone's near someone's backyard, and you think it's probably pretty low. So the enrichment on our design is now within the box, less than 5%. So it utilizes the existing infrastructure. It fits within the existing regulatory framework, and I think most importantly, or very importantly for nuclear power, it fits with inside what has been accepted by the public. So it all gets back to, is this going to be an academic exercise? We sit around and talk about things and makes nice designs on paper. We're actually trying to build something that makes a difference. And when you actually want to build something, you better take into account the policy realities that are required. And so we put this thing back into less than 5% enrichment, even though from a technical standpoint, you probably would come up with a different answer. Relative to refueling and O&M, we spent a lot of time on that. Another great question, because at the end of the day, the operators, the utilities, have to feel comfortable maintaining these things and working on these things. And so our design uses a containment structure that is similar to, although not equivalent to, what is currently utilized. It's smaller. It's got less parts into it. But in terms of a utility that operates the current fleet, which, quite frankly, those are going to be the early adopters of this technology. There are lots of applications, oil sands you mentioned, but that's never going to be the first adopter of modular. It's going to be people who know how to operate nuclear plants that are going to embrace this, and they're going to want something that they are familiar with and comfortable with, which is why we've chosen the path we have. With regard to cooling, yes, we've selected an air-cooled approach. You lose a little bit of efficiency, but you really decouple the application of this thing from the water rights challenge. And again, with regard to oil sands, you know, the application of nuclear for process heat requirements is a little bit different, obviously, than power generation, and you would need to make some changes on the secondary side. But again, from the perspective of first things first, oil sands, tar sands, Alberta is not going to be the first place that adopts a modular nuclear reactor. They don't know how to operate those, and there's all kinds of issues with licensing and siting. And so the goal of the program here is to focus on a realistic early adopters and create the solution for them first. Walk before you run. I think that's the right philosophy for modular nuclear.
Number one, enrichment for us is also less than 5%, probably peaking at around 3 to 4. Refueling access and maintenance, I understand why you're uncomfortable with the level of detail. We gave a presentation to INPO that was an hour and a half, and we spent a lot of time talking about that. So I'd be happy to talk to you about that, but it goes into a whole lot more detail and pictures and things that we just don't have time for here. But, yes, we've given a lot of thought to access for maintenance and refueling and all of those questions, just how you do it, what the process is, and so forth. Heat rejection, you know, there's nothing unique about any plant that says you can or can't go to dry cooling. I was at Pacific Power. We had a coal plant in Wyodak that was air-cooled. You could put an air-cooled system or a wet-cooled. It depends on the customer. It depends on the area. And we're certainly looking at that as an option. process heat applications, it really gets down more to whether or not the steam conditions you have are the steam conditions that the process applier wants. Do we produce steam at a high enough temperature and a high enough pressure to suit their needs? And so we have those conversations from time to time. Designing a facility where you take our module, you put the systems around it, and you change the secondary system, I think that's just a matter of doing it if you have a customer who says that we want your process heat. So we're open to those conversations. And, frankly, there's one area of the world we're having a conversation with someone that's very interested in our plant for specifically that purpose.
All right. First of all, as I said before, our approach at Hyperion is to use the Hyperion power module and certify it with these marquee regulatory agencies for a range of applications that's quite wide that would stay under our safety umbrella, all the way from all heat, steam, desalinization, no electricity, all the way to all electricity, and in the middle, a mix. So we're very flexible, and we may, and many of our potential clients are interested in retrofitting existing balance of plant, so that that helps answer some of the functional questions. As long as it's within our safety envelope, we provide the energy. As regards some of the logistics, the training, for instance, will have to be, as the gentleman have said, for the lead launch clients, and indeed in every case, we'll have to make sure there's an operating company that contains nuclear expertise, though there may be a dozen or less folks that are needed for the plant, the whole plant. They will be multi-skilled individuals. The operating company will have nuclear credentials certified by WANO and so forth. And we will, as in many cases in the world, go two or three generations of HPMs as we train the local folks who will pick up and be certified themselves. The final point on Q&A for us is the enrichment. HPMs will, there's more than one product, but basically depending on the burn-up and depending on the life, the enrichment may vary, but in all cases will be less than 19.9% enriched per existing international guidelines.
Commitments?
Say again?
Customers.
Okay. Unfortunately, on that one, thank you for reminding me. Those commitments are bound by covenant, so I really can't say anything else.
I didn't think that you were addressing the question to me, but in terms of enrichment, I think I've answered your question in my presentation. And the other aspects of your question depends upon the details of what the reactor is going to look like. As I said, we're attempting to build a demonstration model. We think that with the sort of molten salt design that we have in mind, it is possible to renew the fuel almost continuously. The reactor is going to be stirred constantly by convection currents, and the fuel is then fed in almost on a continual basis. I don't know if that answers your question. Okay.
Okay, Joe Dukert, you're done. Dean Chang, what are your next steps? So what needs to happen for GemStar? You talked about a pilot plant, and you talked about...
Yeah, that's what we are aiming for. I think that we have done as much of the testing as we can do on each of the separate pieces of the technology that is required. So, for example, as I said, it's graphite mediated. We look at the particular kind of graphite and we see whether or not it is possible to have the specifications that we want. We looked at the accelerator pieces. We've studied the cross sections and so forth. They're all there. We need to put it all together in a workable model, and that's what we are trying to do.
Okay, great. Questions? Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, Rebecca Cooper with Nuclear New Build Monitor. The Department of Energy has just recently started talking about adding a small reactors line to their budget, talking about these reactors specifically and supporting them. But exactly what that's going to be is still largely up in the air. So I'm curious as to, for each of you, how important government support is for your project. I mean, you know, we're doing light water reactors that are still very dependent on the support coming from the government, be it through loan guarantees or the MP2010 program. So, you know, what kind of commitment are you willing to make if you're not sure how much support's going to be coming from the government at this point?
Great, great question. I guess the first thing I would say is that the need for loan guarantees is a symptom of one of the problems with gigawatt class reactors. It gets back to betting your company and who's where are you going to get financing for something that's greater than the market capitalization of your company. So, I think that of all of the challenges out there, that's one of the challenges that the idea of a modular, scalable approach to nuclear is trying to address. So I think if you go back and say, well, hey, you still need a loan guarantee for a modular reactor, you probably haven't solved anything. So I guess our position, and based upon a lot of discussions in the industry, is sure, everybody would love loan guarantees, but the idea is that with a modular approach where you're talking about on the order of a $1 billion project as opposed to a $10 billion project, you're not betting the company, and it's much more within the zone of projects that are typically financed outside of nuclear space by these companies. So loan guarantees are not, by definition, a prerequisite for modular. With regard to the DOE program, what I can say there is, based upon the interest we've had in the industry, you know, we are committed to go forward. However, the DOE program can help reduce risk and ensure that there is a timely deployment of modular reactors by facilitating the process and facilitating regulatory reviews of modular nuclear. So, it should be viewed as a way to buy down risk for the deployment of modular nuclear on a timely basis within the U.S.
In our case, we started investments and started moving forward on this program with no hope or expectation of a government program. Having said that, it's very important for customers. The customers need to have a way to get past the first plant, and a DOE program can be a major help there. A DOE program could be a major help in validating what we're doing. It could be a major help in facilitating the process, especially with the NRC. And so there are a lot of different ways, and frankly, it could help in buying down the risk, as Chris said, going forward with our investors and on our side of the table as well. So it's a major, major step forward in terms of the real issue, which is advancing the potential for these reactors to hit the marketplace and have an impact.
Okay, one other aspect, I agree with the gentleman. In our particular case, we are working with a government lab. The transfer of or commercialization of technology is a traditional a positive aspect of our government, including the Department of Energy. I think the resources and the use of the resources at the DOE labs, which are impressive, and mostly the people. There are some impressive people at the U.S. DOE labs. I would expect that it would be beneficial, both in time and reduction of risk and certainty, to perhaps get some of those folks involved in some of the reviews and or have access to some of the resources for testing and so forth. So, yes, I think that would be quite helpful, and it would be beneficial and justified at the beginning until we get into advanced manufacturing mode.
GEMSTAR is absolutely in the research and the developmental stage, and as such, therefore, the dependence on the DOE and other agencies would, in fact, be a critical piece of what it is that that we wish to do. I should mention that it's not just simply, you know, when you try to integrate a system as GEMSTAR, the way GEMSTAR is constructed, You're going to get results and other spin-offs in terms of the scientific research that, in fact, it's been the traditional role of the Department of Energy, particularly in the Office of Science.
Article Schneider, General Atomics. Can each one of you tell when is the first of a kind module may be producing electricity power, and first of a kind when that may be operating?
Yeah, as we look at our timeline, we see the lead plant being up and operational before 2020, so 2018-2019 time frame.
Same.
We look for a lead launch, which are the first several of the Hyperions to be online in the middle of the next decade.
We're certainly hoping to have this first demonstration model up within 5 years or so.
Bo Kong from Johns Hopkins says, thank you for the enlightening presentations. Based on your description, except the GemStar, it doesn't seem to me other technologies are resistant against non-proliferation concerns or concerns about uranium supplies. Your technologies will still have to enrich uranium. They won't use natural uranium, and with the dependency, with the concerns about uranium supplies mounting, and also, I guess the other thing is, the world is going through this nuclear renaissance now, and as such, there are mounting concerns associated with this concern, and it doesn't seem to me this technology will address those concerns. These technologies won't close the fuel cycle. So I wonder how you can convince policymakers and nuclear skeptics that this technology, you know, these technologies are worth commercialization on in a timely fashion. Thank you.
Well, a couple of things. One is from a proliferation perspective, and I think you got to get back to being realistic about what's going on here. You know, in our particular case, we have a fuel cycle that's a 5-year operating cycle as opposed to 18 months. So, you know, clearly the need to have access to the reactor on a 5-year frequency as opposed to a year and a half is something that moves you in the right direction. The use of standard light water reactor fuel means that, and I'm assuming we're talking about the application of nuclear into developing country, means that the developing country can access fuel from Western's, you know, well-established, reputable Western suppliers, as opposed to inventing or accessing a fuel supply chain that we don't know anything about, and it comes from sources that we don't know where they are. As you mentioned yourself, the fact is that developing countries, and I think a great example is the UAE, is moving forward with new nuclear. So, you know, nuclear skeptics exist today. They're going to continue to exist, but they don't seem to be slowing down the adoption of nuclear power in developing countries. So I see very little need to change those individuals' minds because they don't seem to have relevance to the adoption of nuclear in a lot of these developing countries. I think developing countries, these countries are very practical. They want a technology that's established to plug into existing fuel supply chain. You know, relative to closing the fuel cycle, I mean, that's a whole different discussion. But I can tell you there's many people on the side that says reprocessing is not efficient and not necessarily the right way to go, and i.e. you shouldn't even bother doing it and instead spend your time coming up with the right place to create permanent storage as it is to closing the cycle. So I think the real objective here for modular and any new nuclear technology is to decouple in the medium term the deployment of the technology with the fuel cycle issue. And that's going to take some time to be resolved. So, again, for us, you know, we've decided to create a scenario where all the used fuel can be stored inside this underground containment for the life of the plant. Hopefully 60 years from now, we will have a solution to that.
I guess I would say that I don't think, with maybe the GemStar exception, that we're talking about technologies that change that conversation a whole heck of a lot. We don't find customers, frankly, that are worried about whether there's enough uranium out there. I think that's an issue that I don't hear in circles of buyers and sellers and investors. That being said, there are conversations about other fuel cycles, and we're involved in one of those, particularly thorium. And if you're following that issue, I'm sure you're aware of the advantages of a thorium fuel cycle. Thorium could fit into our reactor. I think that's a picture that some people have about where the thing goes long term. But our technologies at this table, I don't think they're going to change that conversation. That's a conversation that's an important part of the nuclear policy question, and there's a lot of different ways to have that conversation. But these technologies, at least ours, doesn't change that a lot.
The other thing I'd like to add to what the other gentlemen have said is that we do have the ability to adapt. I think that each of us is designing our small modular reactors with that issue in mind. If from an evolutionary standpoint, if you look at the situation as we see it may exist by the middle of the next decade and towards the end of the next decade, it may be possible to develop new fuels. In the particular case of Hyperion, we plan on making many of these over many years, so that we are going to be flexible and make all attempts to improve. However, that being said, the thresholds of enrichment we're talking about here have been very thoroughly reviewed and studied by folks that are spend their lives concerned about proliferation in any case are below a level of probable events or terrorist concerns. That is absolutely one of the issues that we're concerned about and we will be designing into our plants.
Hi, Chris DeVault, USUA Business Council. We've talked about the financing and the energy creation, but what about job creation or sustaining U.S. jobs? If a power plant decided to use these new technologies, is there any idea of how many jobs it would create or sustain?
Well, we've taken a first look at that. We're the only remaining North American manufacturer of nuclear reactors, and so we already have an existing infrastructure out there in a number of states to manufacture these. So it certainly would be a made-in-America type solution, whether it's for U.S. application or to export. In this sense, modular nuclear is really the only exportable commodity from a nuclear perspective besides fuel that really creates jobs in the U.S. for an export market, because you can't export a gigawatt-class plant. It's too big. You got to make it on site. But we've taken a first look, and you know, you're talking about 500,000 incremental jobs in our factories, given the projections that we have for this product, again, in the near term future before 2020.
Actually, I would say there's five major North American companies that have been actively engaged in nuclear manufacturing as part of the Navy program. The five companies are Babcock and Wilcox, Curtis Wright, Precision Custom Cast Parts, Electric Boat, and Northrop Grumman. Three of those companies are in our supply chain. And so we are talking about creating jobs in the U.S. with what we're doing. The issue of how many jobs, I guess that's another conversation. Whatever it's going to be, if our plants get purchased at the level the demand is there, and it's going to be a significant number.
We have a firm that's based in the U.S. We have offices in Denver and Los Alamos and in Washington, D.C. When the Hyperion power modules are manufactured, assembled, and exported, the plan is from the U.S. they would be exported and then taken back as a form of servicing and replaced with new HPMs. So therefore, the job situation, whether it's 500 or 1,000 jobs, I mean, it depends on do you sell 100, do you sell 500. We have smaller reactor, but we can sell larger numbers. The important thing is the fact that the United States can and will retain a key role, not only in the United States, but around the world with our technology. So we think that's important, and we think that's an important aspect of the formation of our firm.
Perhaps to answer your question, I could answer the previous question was raised about the fuel cycle. In many respects, GEMSTAR can try to attempt at closing that cycle. We the particular system, in fact, can thrive on unused fuel, is that the way you said? The unused fuel from light water reactors, and to the extent that that's going to be a growing problem as reactors as described by the other three panelists were to take off, we will be there to take advantage of those unused fuels. And since it requires a relatively new set of technologies, particularly in putting it all together, the jobs will be, in fact, fairly substantial.
Let me make a comment and then pose a question. So going back to Bo's comment, as we've looked at different fuels and different solutions, whether it's jobs or climate or economics or security, we found with the exception of efficiency, there's trade-offs in almost everything. So you may solve, you know this, you solve a certain set of problems, may create others, or you don't actually get to those problems. The question I have, so applicability outside of the U.S. where we're looking to replace existing coal fire facilities, applications for China, India, where do you see this fitting in for other countries internationally?
Well, as I indicated earlier, you know, one of the big challenges for developing countries is their transmission grid. So, you know, China and India have a special problem in that they have absolutely huge requirements for new power. And so that, taking that perspective on the challenge says, hey, why don't I just go out and build all large nuclear plants? But if you look at the grid, for example, in India, it is just not designed to have centers where you're pumping out 5 or 10,000 megawatts. The grid just can't take that. So there will be, again, I think there will be places where you can put megawatt class reactors in, for example, India, but you're certainly going to need to have the flexibility to scale that down to address the transmission the transmission use. So if you put China and India aside, you're really looking then at the developing countries where the grid is really quite small. And that is really where we see in the long term modular reactors being applied in the greatest number. I mean, if you look at the power demands for the next 20 years, 90%+ of the net addition is outside of North America. So that's really, if you're in the business, you really got to be looking at that, right? So, again, from that standpoint, having a scalable solution that addresses the power requirements in developing countries is what you need to do.
Well, actually, we know they're interested because they called us. We just got back from a trip to China this month at their request and at their invitation to talk to them about their interest in the NuScale plant, both in terms of its process heat and in terms of ways that it could complement the large plants, much in the way we've talked about here. And in China, you've got a huge country with a lot of places that don't have big grids. You've got places that are remote, Tibet, for example, where the idea of building a plant that's very simple to operate and doesn't stress the technical qualifications of the operators in the same way is very attractive to them. So we know there's an interest there. You know, we aren't prepared to say a whole lot about the fact other than we were there and we talked to them, but we know there's interest and we're pursuing that conversation.
Hyperion Power Generation does have interest and commitments from overseas entities, and we find that the interest is oftentimes proportional to how remote or in our case, because we do go after distributed power, it makes common sense that the highest interest is in areas that are remote, but actually have good potential for development. So there's always a different process in every country to determine why something would or an area or a particular town would have good potential. But again, these are up and coming areas that, with more energy, with more water, with more steam and heat, can receive a prompt jump in standard of living, and that's the thing that we're most interested in.
In many respects, of course, the GemStar technology is suitable from the interests of the United States. It's a kind of technology that we would like very much to export and have nuclear energy be available to developing countries, because of some of the issues that we had touched upon earlier. As far as China and India are concerned, China, of course, is a heavy user of coal, and they also realize, perhaps somewhat belatedly, that the downside of using coal is going to cause a huge problem for them in the future, and so they are, in fact, going nuclear. But the thing about China to remember is that the population density is somewhat concentrated along the coast. It's because of the terrain, interior, and so on. But as the population grows, and that's one of the biggest problems that they have in China, they're going to have to make more and more use of the interior. And that's where the power grid issue and, in fact, the non-availability of some of the power stations become an issue. They are concerned about things like proliferation, not in terms of proliferation of some foreign powers making the bomb or anything like that, but security issues. If they would start a nuclear plant somewhere in the middle of the country, the way in which the infrastructure of that government is structured, it is not so easy for them to control things in the interior as they are in the coastal regions. That's one of the biggest issues in China. In India, they are interested also in the nuclear project. India is fairly rich in thorium, so they would be interested in the kind of design that could make use of thorium instead of uranium as the natural fuel. And again, this is something that we can accommodate within the GemStar system.
We'll take one final question. Thank you very much. My name is Zed Haddad, and this is a question I think is sort of timely. I hope it is a good question. But as you know, and as has been pointed out, climate change is now more than all about emission targets. And as such, one of the elements that negotiators are planning to tackle at Copenhagen in December is a sort of new architecture, a new framework for the new clean development mechanism, if there is a binding treaty. As such, there seems to be some talk about them exploring new research initiatives in next-generation nuclear. And here's my question. Are you aware of the efforts by your industry to ensure that nuclear energy is, in fact, incorporated in the new clean development mechanism, which will obviously be a great help to your efforts? Thank you.
I would say there are probably other people in this room that are a lot more capable of answering that question than I am. Those conversations, as I understand it, are going on, but I haven't been part of them. There are other people that play key roles in our industry that I believe have been part of that.
Yeah, I think we have some level of appreciation for that, but I think the challenge that we have from our company is, a fundamental disagreement on the premise that this is really a matter of R&D right now, because we believe that there's enough essentially proven technology out there that relative to climate change, the focus ought to be on deploying the proven technology as opposed to going back into research mode where you're really not going to do anything. I mean, it's a matter of spending money and you really can't rely on an R&D approach to solve anything in the near term. Now, in the long term, and as Paul indicated, I mean, climate change is a long-term challenge. So clearly there needs to be some level of focus on that. But to really focus the discussion into an R&D space, I think really misses, you know, the broader question. And certainly from our perspective, to go back to what I talked about at the beginning, the problem that modular nuclear is trying to solve. We're not trying to solve a technology problem. That's not what the challenge that's facing the nuclear industry right now. They're real-world adoption problems in terms of cost certainty, schedule certainty, and the absolute magnitude of the investment required to get into this thing. And those are, at the end of the day, what we believe modular nuclear needs to focus on, especially if you're going to make an impact to climate change and the need for new power in any time in the near future.
I would put an exclamation point behind that. I think I would need to see an argument that I haven't seen so far that makes me believe that research on next-generation reactors is a critical part of bringing nuclear into a viable climate change strategy. I don't see that as being a critical piece.
Interesting. Okay. All right. I think we have a unique set of problems now. My opinion is that we absolutely need to utilize existing technology better, which we're not doing in nuclear, and get substantial portions of our electricity generation made by nuclear power. I agree with both of these gentlemen, and I've been involved in large nuclear plants, and I find them very safe and effective. And we need those now, and we need those for a long time. Overall, though, I do think that there are substantial issues that people have in the world with nuclear. High capital cost, security, fuel, and waste. So, in parallel with doing our very best to bring nuclear power plants online continuously for as long as we'll all be alive, all right, I think it is necessary to know and recognize and utilize the existing resources that are there. I mentioned before the impressive U.S. Department of Energy labs have staff there now that are involved in future resource research. So do other countries. So I think they're both needed and needed badly, and that we all should recognize that the combination of those two aspects are necessary to make a real dent in climate change problems. That's my opinion. Thank you.
Well, I guess GEMSTAR is an R&D effort of the sort that you're referring to, I think, in your question, in the whole nuclear portfolio. On the other hand, that said, I do agree with some of the statements that have been made by my fellow panelists. There is a proven technology here, and it is not at all clear that the maximum has been taken out or been completely exploited and utilized with the existing technology. But there are these issues having to do with proliferation and the, unused fuel. And I think that there's a lot of research that can and should be done. But then, you know, I'm talking from a university perspective. That's what we do. We look at problems that sometimes people don't even think will exist. And yet, at the same time, it problems that become apparent as you go along in the near term. So this is what we do, and this is what we are thinking about.
One of the things we do here is to try to bridge policy and the business model. My ambition today, because this was a little bit different from what we usually do, was to not only be informational, which I think you all did an extremely good job at, but also a little bit thought-provoking on how things might change, how you tweak it, how you rethink nuclear. And I think our panel totally succeeded on that goal. So if you'll join me in thanking our panelists. let me also tell you, since we talked about fuels, we're going to be doing a global unconventional gas session later on this month with Wood Mackenzie and EIA to talk about new forecasts, what the prospects are for delivering gas, what the resource base is, what are the challenges, because there's challenges there as well. But thank you also very much.